Good afternoon. I'm Rita Chally. This is Ontario Today.
I was 21, and it was just so much fun. I was living the dream. We had just finished playing at the Olympics, had won a silver medal, and on a run with the New York Rangers on their way to winning the first Stanley Cup in 54 years, so things were going in the right direction.
Former NHL goalie Corey Hirsch on how one day he snapped.
I remember that moment, the exact moment in time where things just kind of almost stopped. I was out after a game with a bunch of friends, and then it just felt like something just broke. Thoughts are screaming at me. They're like screaming loud. So I took the stick blade out in my hotel and I just started trying to smash my hand with it. You're at a point where you'll do anything to make the thoughts go away.
Corey Hirsch is one of our guests this hour. He is part of a new public awareness campaign. The point is simple. Mental health is health.
When you're a professional athlete and you have a physical injury, there's protocols in place. You need to do this and we'll have you playing in 3 weeks. When it comes to mental health, we're still throwing a dart at a dartboard.
And this is not just for athletes. How many times have we heard, if you break your arm, you go to the doctor. So why don't you go see someone if your mind is killing you? We may have personal barriers. There are certainly systemic shortages. Let's say you get past that first hurdle and ask for help. Is there a family doctor, a psychiatrist, an addiction facility, something affordable? Corey Hirsch is in our Vancouver studio. His story is both harrowing and reassuring. He's frank about all the times he got close to the edge, including how he once nearly drove a snazzy new sports car right off a cliff. In Toronto, we have Dr. Catherine Zahn. She is a neurologist and the president and CEO of the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. CAMH is the largest mental health hospital in the country. She is one of the most influential voices. We're going to explore why mental health still takes a backseat to other medical problems. Tell us about your moment when something broke, what it took to take a first step, what kind of help was there when you finally asked. This is the toll-free number, 1-888-817-8995. Mental health is health in this hour of Ontario Today.
The thing about having a mental health issue is that you can hide it for only so long. So I go over to the coach and I was like, I can't play. So they called an emergency team meeting. And just the embarrassment and the shame was just the worst thing I could ever imagine. And I remember thinking I just threw my NHL career away. And it was then that I went and saw a therapist. He sits with me for like 15 minutes and he's like, you have obsessive compulsive disorder. I was like, what? And all I had to do was talk to somebody and get diagnosed.
We've been busy tweeting a few links actually this morning, including you can see the Mental Health is Health videos, that one with Corey Hirsch, and also a couple of pieces that he wrote. You can find them all at CBC Ontario Today. You can also communicate with us. And this whole campaign is actually, and I didn't identify that in the opener, maybe it's self-evident, it's something that was launched by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. And again, we have Dr. Catherine Zahn, the president and CEO with us, and also Corey Hirsch. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Listen, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to start more with your own story, Corey Hirsch, because what it does is I think it helps open up a lot of people, right? And a lot of what I just played there, I'm sure, piqued people's interest too, because you have this way of telling your story. I'd like to start maybe one of the pieces we tweeted out. How many darks are in that headline? Dark, 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 dark.
It's pretty dark.
Wow, it's a lot of darks. And this was in the Players Tribune. You published that, a year or so ago?
Yeah, about a year ago, Players Tribune and I connected. And it was probably right around mid-February. So, and ever since the story's come out, it's been quite the whirlwind. Let's put it that way. I've been met with nothing but overwhelming love and support from people. I was terrified before it first came out, right? I mean, you don't know what the reaction is going to be. And it's been nothing but love and support.
Well, let me walk you through it a little bit just to give the listeners a sense, and then we'll talk more about the campaign and some of these other issues. But that piece starts with you. You describe yourself at 21, and there you were on the edge of a cliff. Can you tell the audience, that moment?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not something that I think that I save it for the story, but, you know, I was in a point where I was desperate to stop what was going on in my head, and it wasn't that I wanted to end my own life. It was that, you know, you wanted peace. And I guess, you know, at that point, you're desperate for that. And I know that there's a lot of people out there right now that are desperate for, you know, peace, and it's available, it's out there. So, you know, here I am 25 years later and, you know, leading a really good life. So I'm thankful that it didn't go that way that day.
That's a crazy story, though. I mean, you skidded to a stop.
Yeah.
What did you ever tell anyone that what you almost
no,
did?
No, I mean, I didn't really tell anybody until the story came out. And, you know, it was at the point where, you know, if I was going to tell my story, right, and you're going to throw it out there, you might as well lay it all out there. There's really nothing left to hide. So when you decide to come out with that story, I mean, what are you going to hide, right? I mean, it's to help other people that are in that situation that, you know, that might be thinking the same thing right now.
I wonder if you might reflect a little bit, because I played a little bit from that video. We talk about a moment, sort of like a before and after, I guess you're alluding to. I guess there are people listening, I know, who relate exactly, and those who don't. What is it about that before and after? Like, what happened at the bar when you just...
It's different. There's different... Every mental health issue is a little bit different, and Dr. Zahn can speak a little bit more on that later. You know, with obsessive-compulsive disorder, a lot of the people that I know can remember the moment they were or where they were the moment, you know, that things just kind of, I guess... It's almost as if you have a wire in your brain that just kind of... breaks. And the way I can describe it best is it's like a record player that just, you know, I'm dating myself, but when the needle used to get stuck or I'll give the kids today, the CD gets scratched and it just keeps skipping. But the issue with in your brain is I can't physically lift a needle off to stop the thoughts from skipping. So it becomes repetitive and you're trying to figure out how to stop it. So that's more obsessive compulsive disorder. Most people think it's hand washing and those, you know, but it's the way I was diagnosed is I would do it in my own head. Whereas depression can be more trauma based, you know, something that happened before. And I had a great childhood. So,
well, I got to tell you, can you tell a little bit of this scene? Because again, the story, and we tweeted it out, but you know, for people who are in their cars and hearing you, you talk about a number of things, but there's a moment where you actually do tell your parents that, you know, something terrible is happening. Your mom comes to New York. Can you talk a little bit about that visit?
Well, yeah. So when something like that happens, I knew that something wasn't right. Like something had shifted. So I in the back of my head, I guess I knew it was a mental health issue, but I didn't know what it was. And so you go from thinking that, you know, you're going insane or that, you know, and they're not pleasant thoughts. They never are. You know, mental health can be very degrading, very shameful, very guilt ridden. And that's why people don't reach out to get help. But it's the way I look at it and the way I tell people is that your brain is lying to you. So, you know, at that point, I knew something was wrong. So you're just, like I said, I was desperate. I was reaching out for help from anywhere, from my mom, somebody that knew something. But here's the issue that back then is that, you know, we weren't educated. And that's why I'm on this campaign of educating.
But talk
our
about
children.
That. And we're contemporary. So, yeah. So you talk about your mom coming out, and here she's got this, what, you were maybe in your early 20s. You're living the dream. You've made it to something.
Yeah.
And you go to the Empire State Building with her.
Yeah. You know, I went up to the top of the Empire State Building with her and you know, I told her that I wanted to end my life and that, you know, that's your mom with my mom. You know, I was on a run with the New York Rangers. We're going to win the Stanley Cup and we just won a silver medal. But the only person I knew to turn to was my own parents, right? I mean, that could help me, that I didn't want to tell anybody else that would try and help me, you know, relieve these thoughts and that. So that's what I mean. If I had been educated in school, if I'd have been educated in school or educated in, you know, when I was younger, that this could happen, you know, I could have gotten help the next day. Instead, you go to hide it because you don't know what it is.
It's complicated, though. I want to bring in Dr. Catherine Zahn. What are you hearing in Corey Hirsch's story? I know it's not new for you, but even as you hear it again, what are you thinking about?
I'm hearing the whole spectrum of his story is so fascinating from this point of view, and the description of having something occur suddenly. But I'll bet on reflection, Corey, and I think we talked about this a little bit. There would be little things that you would pass off as being ordinary: anxiety before a game, or a feeling that you had to rearrange your pencils before an exam, and then it sneaks up and becomes more physical and intense. And there, and we don't talk about this in society, so we do have that sense that it's something secret and it's something that we as an individual are alone in, and so we don't reach out for help because somehow we understand it to be a defect in ourself. When these symptoms are so common at all stages in life. And again, Corey's very correct in saying that if we did have a certain openness to it, alertness, if we had systems in place for early recognition, there are very, very good therapies that are valuable, particularly when they're implemented in younger age groups. Things like cognitive behavioral therapy or structured psychotherapy. There are many jurisdictions in the world where this is available through the public publicly funded systems, and they have shown very dramatic outcomes and improvement in outcomes in the children and young adults.
I was going to wait, but I think, you know, people might be curious. Can you give one example of a cognitive therapy that is not easily available that maybe people are paying for privately if they are somehow really attuned and able to provide it for their kids that you think, you know, what this would really solve a lot, something that would illustrate it in a simple way?
In our healthcare system right now, psychotherapy is funded if it's funded through a hospital or in the community through a physician interaction. Most cognitive behavioral therapy and other forms of structured psychotherapy are provided by psychologists, social workers, sometimes nurses, and there's no funding mechanism for that. If you have private insurance, if you have supplementary insurance, it may provide therapies for a few hundred dollars a year, and that would provide you with perhaps two and a half sessions of psychotherapy.
I wanted people to kind of understand. Let's use the example for Corey Hirsch. Do you remember organizing pencils, obviously? That's something you did as a kid?
Yeah? Me? No. Everything's done in my head.
Oh, okay. but let's say, you know, a parent, like they hear that scenario and say, yeah, you know, they're rearranging the shoes or something. Mm-hmm. Like Dr. Zahn, like what is a therapy, if you can, in a brief way, that would actually help and prevent maybe some of these other kind of things going off the rails later on?
Well, the structured psychotherapies are really action-oriented, so they're having an individual describe or appreciate the sensation that they're experiencing, understanding that their response to, let's say, a relatively benign situation is what's referred to as an automatic thought or an automatic feeling, but it's not a rational response. And so there are exercises that help people center themselves, be mindful, and practice responding in a more generative way.
I'm curious, Corey Hirsch, do you relate to this? Like, do you do something that even now you do like a treatment for yourself when you find yourself slipping down a road?
I'm always, I use therapy as a regular almost as seeing a doctor.
Yeah, but so, that's a yeah. one-on-one. But is there a cognitive trick that if you ever, you know, you get one of those those thoughts, you actually trying to correct it somehow? I'm trying to actually understand or see or help the audience see what that is if you've never done it.
No, it's you know, for me, everything's done in my head, so it's you can't see it, right? So it's more one-on-one individual therapy that I'll go see,
and that helps you.
And it's some. Yeah, it's nothing physical, so it's not like you can just say, hey, stop
stop doing that, stop washing your hands, or stop. No, for me, it's mental, and it's going to see a therapist, and sometimes just getting a little refresher.
Okay, like a touchstone. Listen, we've got lots of callers, and I'll invite both of you, you know, to jump in. We're in different places, but if there's something one of a caller is saying, they may have something directed at either of you specifically, or feel free to jump in. Corey Hirsch is one of our guests, and Dr. Catherine Zahn, who is the president and CEO of the Center for Mental Health and Addiction. I got that right? No, I flipped it around. Let's CAMH. Sean, you're on the line in London, Ontario. What does this have you thinking of?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Catherine and Corey for being a part of this conversation and for you for hosting it. My daughter, I've been working through the mental health system for 20 years with my daughter, and what I want to say is that I'm tired of using the word stigma. And the reason I'm tired of the word stigma is that we should stop talking about it as a stigma and talk about it for what it is, which is a prejudice. And that's because in no other medical area do you have to, like if you broke an arm, had diabetes, had a heart injury, a cancer, whatever the medical issue is, you would get immediate and very expert care. When it comes to mental illness, we deal with crisis. And often people are waiting from 6 months to 2 years. And if adult mental health is the orphan of the medical health system, then child and youth mental health is the orphan of the orphan. And the last point I want to...
Sean, can I ask you a question? Ahead. Yeah, no, I'm curious. Because I hear what you're saying, because it's the point of this. I never used deliberately the word stigma. But tell me why, when you say stop using it, do you feel that? Like, have you felt that, you know, going through the system with your daughter?
Well, only because... Not from the people who work in the system. It's how it's funded. It's how it's taken care of. So it is a prejudice, because people are treated... in a markedly different way if you have a mental illness.
Like what?
You don't get immediate access to care.
Like your daughter, so 20 years is a long time. What has been her issue in general?
Well, I mean, first as a parent, you're in charge of navigating the system, and you know, child and youth mental health is split between five ministries, and so you're dealing with that. It's not a part of the health system per se, the Ministry of Health. And so you have to find your way, you know, from a doctor to a community mental health agency, to the hospital, to, you know, in inpatient care systems, to funding your own, to funding therapy. You know, Catherine said that as well. You know, we don't pay for therapy.
So it's incoherent in a way.
Out of our medical system. So it's a prejudice. You know, it's not a stigma. It's a prejudice.
Can I just verify Sean is saying, Dr. Zahn? Is that true?
You sure can.
Not children mental health services not funded through the Ministry of Health?
So partially okay. True, but I just want to go back to his point about stigma. I couldn't agree more, and you would rarely hear me refer to it as that, and I use the words prejudice and discrimination, and we have there are historical reasons for this that part of our advocacy campaign is trying to supersede, and we have antidotes to prejudice. They're education and familiarity, discrimination we have laws against. So I'm on a campaign to make sure that we're demanding justice and equity in
mental health
care funding. But who's
your audience? Like, in one way, I hear this, and I think, you know, between Bell Talk or whatever, you know, Let's Talk, like, everybody talks, it seems, about this, but not really, I guess, still.
So my first audience is the public, because I want to put out there a call to action for strong advocacy in support of mental health from all Canadians. We know that 20% of Canadians have the experience of mental illness, but in surveys, only 2% believe it's an important or a pressing health issue. So we need the people to rise up, so to speak. It's also a message to our funders that we need to streamline the mechanism, and we need to put them more in line with the.
But what do you mean by the way funders? You mean like
government?
Political parties, governments? We're in a campaign right now. Seems like a perfect time. It is deliberate timing, perhaps, on the part of CAMH.
Our governments at large. This is hardly a partisan issue, and we've been talking about this for years. This is simply a matter of justice and equity.
Okay. Let's go to Kelly in Toronto. How do you relate to this? What has it got you thinking of?
Hi. First of all, thanks so much for having the show, Corey and Rita. It's, for me, awareness is the biggest thing because it helps people look for patterns and break the patterns. For me, I gained a bit of weight between grade 8 and grade 9, just 5 or 10 pounds, and I started dieting all through high school and all through university, and every time I broke my diet, which was basically to eat almost nothing because I thought there's such poor diet information out there, that I would try to punish myself and to be more disciplined because there's such an emphasis on being disciplined and determined and having willpower. And that just escalated to the point in university. One night I just pretended I was doing laundry with all my housemates and piled all my belongings into garbage bags and just distributed them because it was garbage day down the street. But I just pretended I was going to the laundromat because I was trying to punish myself and make myself feel determined the next morning. But the next morning when I woke up in an empty room, I just felt really flat for the first time because for the previous 8 years, I always say it took me 10 years to lose 10 pounds because it took like that time to me finally stop being optimistic that tomorrow will be different. And that drove me to go to the medical center at university. And I think it was being anonymous sort of at university, not going to my family doctor. This is in 1996 when mental health didn't have a big... But anyways, my doctor, similar to what Corey said, he said it's like a broken record. Like, first of all, he said, do you see patterns in your life? And I said, no, not at all. I need to work harder. I need to be a better person, you know. And he was saying that you're starving, binging, purging, punishing yourself. And, you know, that could happen twice a day. It could happen, a couple times a week. Like, well, it was most days. But, so just as soon as I knew there was a pattern, it really helped me really look for that pattern and be able to break it. It's very hard because it feels so right to do what you've always done. And by then it had been ingrained for 8 years. It was just the way I operated. So, and I do, looking back when I was young, I was a straight A student. I athlete of the year, all that kind of stuff. And, so I was always trying to find a way to perfect things more. Like the straightening pencils thing for me, it was like, I want to take my textbooks home and draw a line so all my lowercase letters are perfect. So I think I was like looking for a project, and when I gained weight I was like, okay, I'm gonna do this. But it sort of...
How are you these days? How are you these days, Kelly?
I've been healthy for the last 18 years. It really is looking for patterns because it does seep into other parts of your life. Once I started eating 3 balanced meals a day, all of that sorted itself out. So it really was just getting educated on how to eat properly, and then also having the support of the medical center to diagnose me and that kind of thing.
I'd like to get a response maybe very quickly. We're going to head to our break in about a minute. Corey Hirsch, maybe first from you.
Well, my first thought is that I'm extremely proud of you for getting yourself help and doing what you needed to do to get better, and just realizing that help is available. This is a person that we're listening to that was stuck in a pretty dark place, just like I was. And it's hope that for other people that are out there struggling right now, it's hope that they can get better and that help is available, treatment is available. You just got to reach out and get it.
Very quickly, Dr. Zahn, as we head away for our break, both this caller, Corey Hirsch, a lot of these stories seem to be patterns in youth and then something around, young adulthood. Is that consistent?
Absolutely consistent. And I too, you brought a smile to my face, Kelly, when you said that you were healthy. And this is one of those conditions that is so complicated because there are such severe physical or non-psychiatric components of it, and there's such a need for a comprehensive wraparound care, and it can be so hard to get that.
Okay, and yes, we haven't even gotten into geography. That's a very real barrier, if I call it a systemic barrier. We're talking about Mental Health is Health. It's a new public awareness campaign, and two of the people behind it, Dr. Catherine Zahn, the president and CEO at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, and Corey Hirsch. You might remember him from his goalie days or enjoy him as a sports commentator these days. We're back after this break. You're listening to Ontario Today. I'm Rita Chelli. In this hour, why does mental health still take a back seat to other medical problems?
I remember that moment, the exact moment in time where things just kind of almost stopped. I was out after a game with a bunch of friends, and then it just felt like something just broke. Thoughts are screaming at me. They're like screaming loud. So I took the stick blade out in my hotel, and I just started trying to smash my hand with it. You're at a point where you'll do anything to make the thoughts go away.
Former NHL goalie Corey Hirsch. He is part of a new public awareness campaign launched by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health just a few days ago. CAMH is the largest mental health hospital in the country. The president and CEO, Dr. Catherine Zahn, is in our Toronto studio. Mental health is health. What was the moment perhaps you decided to take a step and get help? Was help there when you asked? 1-888-817-8995. Our Twitter handle is at CBC Ontario Today.
I can't breathe. I have migraines, numbness, weight loss. I live with it every day. The illness that I'm suffering from is an anxiety disorder. And it deserves to be treated like any other illness. But it's not.
Part of that campaign, we've tweeted out a link to it, a couple of the pieces written by Corey Hirsch. Nicholas, you've been patiently waiting on the line in Toronto. Tell us about what's on your mind.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. It's an incredibly important piece of work. I nursed my wife for 9 months with a very nasty cancer, and she died eventually in an emergency ward due to red tape. And that set me off on a path of mental illness. Mm. I had been writing a book in bits on Facebook and garnered quite a lot of friends. And the third time I thought of driving my car into a buttress on a highway at high speed, I did a cry for help. I got a number of people who came back and said, amongst other things, wow, men don't normally do that. And I found a lay preacher to become my therapist. And it's working very well. We sit, we talk. And I am much, much better. I have some OCD, but, you know, whatever. My trouble was, sorry.
Yeah, Nicholas, I'm sorry for your loss. It sounds like it was fairly recent.
Well, it was 3 years ago.
Yeah. But I mean, for you, you said mental illness, but it sounds like you went into a depression, to be more specific, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, quite a bad one. And I tried to self-medicate with alcohol, but luckily didn't go too far down that route, and I'm now backing out of it. Well, and I had an abusive father, too, so that sort of set me up through lack of anger management for trouble down the road, and that was the trigger.
Meaning, what do you mean that was the trigger?
My wife died.
Yeah. Well, how long had you two been together?
25 years, and she died at 54. Oh, I'm older.
Okay, but she was, yeah, that's a painful, grief is terrible, right? And it probably, not only the loss, but maybe, as you say, you started seeing other contexts of all your life, eh, that you started looking at?
And yes, and I have a very retentive memory, so that made it very difficult because the day she died was a nightmare, mm-hmm. and it still keeps coming back, and there's nothing you can really do about it. You say things as a form of post-traumatic.
So when you've referred to a kind of healing, I guess, you talked about a pastor. Have you ever taken a medical route to seek any sort of help?
I went to a professional once who said basically the same thing to me, which is, yeah, you're stuck a bit between a rock and a hard place, but actually you're doing better than a lot of other people because I'm active in my community and so on. But mm-hmm. the internalization through the nightmare day and all that sometimes makes it just comes up and hits you in the face.
Yeah, you know what? You're getting at something interesting there. And maybe to you, Dr. Zahn, I do an open line show, so I talk to a lot of people. So you know what I hear in that, and I don't know if it's ringing for you, is the idea that you're not bad enough. There's somebody worse than you, so yes. You can go off and take care of things because you're actually doing better. Although, as Nicholas is saying, his pain was pretty enormous, right? Mm-hmm. How much do people run into that? That once they may ask for help, but they're like, well, you're still a high functioning person. You're still showing up at work, and meanwhile, they're dying inside. Mm-hmm.
So generous of you to share that story with us, Nicholas. And the heartbreak, of course, is that it is too common. And there are a number of things through Nicholas's story that are really important. The one misperception, I think, is that men can't suffer depression, or they should be stronger, or just buck up, particularly if they appear to outward appearances they appear normal and have supports surrounding them, but depression is all too common in men, and suicide is more frequent in men than in women. So the obstacles to getting care are many. One is that we've talked about is the fear or the shame of being exposed, of being weak. The second is many of our providers haven't had the education that gives them the tools, and perhaps in current medical practice, not the time to spend on individuals to provide even the basics of psychotherapy. So we need to do better in all of those spheres.
Okay, Nicholas, take care. Thank you for your call. We're going next to Chris in Kingston. Tell us your story.
Hi, Rita. Thank you for taking my call. I'll try to give my background for context, but just briefly. I probably started having depression and anxiety in my teens and, just sort of coming and going throughout my life until it really came to a head after my first child was born and was significantly depressed postpartum. And had a really difficult time actually navigating the mental health care system to get what I needed. I knew what I needed and even had a very good doctor who was trying to help me get it. And it was so difficult to finally get there. And the sad part is, in preparation for having children, I had actually been trying to get cognitive behavioral therapy prior to even being pregnant. And very long story short, it was 5 years from starting that journey to actually getting on with a therapist and be able to get the help I need. And the reasons for that were sort of a mixture of, I think, some doctors that didn't take me seriously, and then just some logistic things like referrals getting lost, being resubmitted, getting lost again, and then two very compassionate healthcare workers that were just frankly underworked and underpaid and overworked. Mm-hmm. But I didn't call in, your guest hopefully can appreciate this, to be the negative Nancy about the broken system, but rather that experience, I think, is maybe one of the things that helped me out of the depression eventually.
What do you mean,
of course,
by
along with a good therapist?
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by experience?
The experience of like going through the mental health system and various referrals and that sort of thing.
Do you know what I'm curious about when I hear you, though? Because you sound very like you have like the warrior heart or something. You weren't going to give up, and so you were doing things anticipating that they could go badly, and then they did.
Thank you for saying so. But I guess maybe what I'm saying is going through that experience, kind of giving me that warrior heart. And I'll explain what I mean. When you have depression and you spend an awful lot of time telling yourself things like, you know, you're worthless and this sort of thing, going through an exercise of having to actually advocate for yourself and say, no, I am worth this and I deserve this care and I can't afford to pay for it, so I'm going to hold the system to task, I think that was actually a big part in what eventually brought me to where I am now, which is a very happy life, I think. And so I guess what I'm saying is the answer is, you know, not that we don't need to fix the inadequacies in the system, but we have to on all levels kind of empower ourselves and have doctors and other workers empower their patients that they are partners in this process. They're not a problem. Their illness is not a problem to be solved, or they're not a problem to be solved.
Yeah. Well, you took initiative, so that's important. And the other thing in your story, though, is that, frankly, on some level, I'm exhausted, though, and truly listening to you, because you still had it in you. Like, there's some people are depressed, and they're almost, I don't know if this is a medical term, really, the catatonic kind of, can't put the one foot out of bed, mm-hmm. right? So you're in that position. And you might try to get help. Someone needs to carry you at certain points, maybe. And that
your first caller mentioned stigma, and I think unfortunately, or prejudice, and it is true. And ironically, it was actually I'm a nurse by trade, so I'm in the healthcare system.
Ah, there it goes. Now we all understand more.
Well, it's interesting because you see it from that other point of view. You see, this worker that I'm dealing with, they're struggling in their professional capacity, to be able to meet the needs that are in the community. And then also, sometimes when I met someone who was not quite so compassionate, it was sort of, I would never say something like that to a patient, so I'm going to hold you to task.
Right. Chris, I'm going to hold you there if I can, just for the sake of trying to get on as many voices as we can. But good, I'm glad to hear your smile and that you feel, you're in a much better place, and that, yes, that fighting and being a participant and fighting for yourself actually was a point of some honor for you too, and enjoying the success that came with that. Marie, you're calling us, I think, in Barrie?
Yes.
Hi, tell us about what you wanted to talk about.
I got emotional with your screener. This is very close to my heart, but I'm going to try and keep it together here on the radio. I have a 19-year-old son who has not been medically diagnosed, but by Dr. Mom, I know he has anxiety, depression, explosive behavior, and OCD for sure. And I'd like to know how I convince him to go and talk to someone. I know that's what he needs to do, and that's the first step, but he refuses and says he doesn't want to sit with a stranger and talk about his problems. And I need some help on how I talk him into getting help.
Has he read my story?
Pardon me?
It's Corey Hirsch here. How are you? And I know I feel your pain. I can. I want you to look. I want you to Google my name. I want you to look at my story, and I want you to give it to him. Okay. There's two out there, and by the Players Tribune. You can start with that. And then, Catherine, I'll let you take this one because you'll know I'm not qualified to, tell you how to deal with this. But, Catherine, do you have anything you can
add? I just want to add one thing. I agree this is a very, very difficult situation. And one of the things that you have to do is take care of yourself. And sometimes you have to carry the hope for a little while until he's open and receptive. So I think it's important that you speak to somebody yourself, an expert, and get advice about the specifics of the situation to help you deal with it and support him until he's able. But I think for a young person, hearing something like Corey's story or going on Twitter and seeing there's lots of conversation about youth who are struggling and how important it is to get helps and to get care and supports.
Marie, if I might, when you have raised it, sounds like you have tried to talk to your son about it, your 19-year-old. Does he concede that he's not in a great place? Like, do you guys...
Oh, for sure. Yes. He knows. But like I said, he doesn't want to take that step. And I have heard said that when it comes to mental health, it takes emotional strength to reach out for help, where more than, physical strength.
Does he want to feel better? Like, when you talk, do you get a sense that if you said, look, you can actually feel better, I can help you find a way to feel better, do you think that would make any difference?
Yeah, I could try those words. For sure.
I wonder if stay on the line, because Corey Hershey jumped right in there, and you were also my instinct to hear from, and you did exactly what I thought you'd say. What is it about, you think, that a 19-year-old young man, let's call him, but a boy for all the moms listening, or dads, right? Like, that you think in your story, is it because, you know, you were his age when things started to break down and that you're so direct about, you know, all
well,
the...
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been there. I've lived it. So here's my thing. Part of the reason that you don't want to reach out, and part of it is, you know, some of it's stigma, but a big part of it is that you don't want to find out what you don't want to... you're scared of what you're going to find out, right?
Right.
And that's part of what really kept me from getting health is that even those negative words and thoughts keep you down. But it's, you know, it's no different for me than people, someone that has diabetes or cancer. You don't, hey, you don't want to, it's hard to go to the doctor and find out, but once you find out, you can get better, right? So you have to take that step and get over that fear of going and finding out. And what I found out was is that I wasted 4 years of my life being terrified of this disorder that I had and trying to hide it. And
can I also ask that original piece? So we've got both tweeted out, actually, Marie, at CBC Ontario Today. There's the You're Not Alone and the previous one called Dark, 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 Multiple Darks. It was in the Players Tribune. Corey Hirsch, you know, my colleague here, he was kind of, you know, he was going on also about other things he's read. They're like Clint Malarchuk's story. He was a goalie, got his throat cut some years ago, and then also, you know, had a very harrowing kind of personal life in many ways. Is that entity, the Players Tribune, publishing a lot of this kind of stuff?
Yeah, they've done a great job with the mental health. Initially it was to do individual player stories, but they've really taken a step where we're seeing a lot of players now, professional athletes, come forward, basketball, baseball, and they've done a wonderful job. And actually in June they'll be receiving an award from the U.S. government on their
okay.
You know, what they've done.
Well, and Marie, for maybe your son, if I don't know if he's into a certain kind of athleticism, but, you know, sometimes these vedettes, celebs, call them what you will, you know, the kind of man-to-man, I think there's a bit of that with Corey Hirsch's story that might, you know, punch through. Listen, we wish you all the best and a lot of courage.
Thanks very much.
Take care. 1-888-817-8995. We've also tweeted out some crisis lines, by the way. Let's go to Gina. You're calling us in Brantford. Go right ahead.
Hi there. So my husband suffers from PTSD, and since we've been together over the past 11 years, I noticed some of the behaviors earlier on, but he's only been officially diagnosed over the past I'd say 3 years. And he was on short-term disability, went back to work, injured himself physically, where he cut his pads of his fingers, and then was on short-term disability again because he just couldn't handle a lot of the triggers that he had at work. And after the short-term disability, because we were having situations with our oldest, who has his own issues, I encouraged him to continue on to long-term disability. Now, short-term disability is taken care of through your work and through the government, but long-term disability is through an insurance company. Well, we haven't seen a dime from the insurance company since January, and that's literally torn our family apart. My husband is just traumatized. We're all traumatized. Recently, I had my own breakdown where I was sent to hospital. And now we are forced to get a lawyer to help us. And meanwhile, he has all the documentation. He's been diagnosed. He has a renowned psychiatrist who has diagnosed him and given the notes and done everything that he can. And yet we're still run through this, you know, terrifying ringer and made to prove and prove and prove and prove again and again and again. And it's so frustrating. And my background is in science. I'm a massage therapist and acupuncturist, and I plan on going back to school, ironically, for psychology, because I want to help people as well. But I fundamentally believe that the government should be responsible for educating us from an early age. We're talking kindergarten, about our anatomy, about our physiology, about our neurology, yeah, and all those things. So that when this comes to crisis, it doesn't come to crisis.
Yeah, no, and I'm hearing a lot there. I want to pick up. I don't want to shift too quickly, because when you raised this stuff about the insurance, that's really important. And what I'm hearing in your story is very clear. There's already a crisis, and then you feel broken through, you know, again, I'll use that word, exhausting. And I want to go to you, to Dr. Zahn. Like, how common is this? Like, you know, you're a CEO, so I don't know how many patients you see or how will you hear nowadays. No, you know what I mean. Like, but is,
yes,
this, like, is this rampant? Is it, so, like, that sounds unkind. That's like the unkindness of a system.
So as a neurologist, this was a very, very common phenomenon that I've dealt with in the past. And I would just say that this is a really clear and egregious example of the prejudice and discrimination experienced by people with mental illness. And to be honest, illnesses that change your behavior and your thinking are still mysterious and sometimes frightening, and the symptoms are often subjective, although in the case of PTSD, that isn't always the case. There can be some very, very objective findings, and you bumping up against that thing where you have to convince people to believe you, and it's unfair, it's unjust, and that's one of the things that we're trying to fight against in our campaign.
And Gina, I wish you well and lots of courage too, because I hear this about mental health, but we could be talking about WSIB, we could be talking about people's mm-hmm. backs. It's like once you've been dealt this, you know, CRAPPY hand, and then you're trying to kind of help correct it, people end up in these enormous battles, which is just so draining. And it's clear, Gina, in your voice that we can hear that. One thing I want to put to you, Dr. Zahn, is kind of happening on Twitter, and even this story, because Gina was going there, you know, educate us as children. And I'm seeing a theme for parents, let's say, of young children who are listening right now, who say, well, we have to be attuned. Like, what's just, you know, kid behavior, and what's, you know, maybe alarm bell behavior? What would you say to someone, just as people are driving or eating their lunch, and they might want to, you know, be alert in their own environment today?
So, if I understand correctly, you're asking me what kind of education programs should we be putting in schools?
No. What is a parent, when they look at their kid today, like, what is obsessive natural for, let's say, the 7-year-old, and what is, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. So, I think the rule of thumb is that if the symptom or the behavior is stopping the child from undertaking their usual activities, doing well in school, and enjoying sports or other recreational activities, if it's stopping them from interacting with their friends, then it's a problem. It's not normal or the normal spectrum of behavior. If it's
okay,
if
so, there's always a lot of coaxing. They don't want to do anything with teens.
Yeah, but there's one very, very specific thing to always watch for is if in schools, that's a danger signal is if your child stops going to school. So watching for the withdrawing from usual activities is really important.
Okay, if a 7-year-old did it, for sure. But I hear what you're saying, that yes, these environments that they're supposed to feel, you know, natural in to some extent, yep. Maybe they don't love everything about it. But okay, Ali, you're next. You're on the line in Toronto. We've been talking about this idea of mental health is health, this kind of double standard. Why does it take a backseat sometimes? What are your thoughts?
Hi, I wanted to share my story. About 2.5 years ago, I was sexually assaulted, and immediately I was given some resources, like the women's hotline, crisis hotline, and like a few clinics. I think there are about 7 altogether. I went and I contacted each one of them, and they all either were not accepting new patients at all, and these are all crisis centers. These aren't just regular therapists. And then other ones didn't have resources available for weeks. Other ones, I was put on waiting lists. Anyway, I never heard back from any of them. And then within a few weeks, I was kind of feeling like maybe I was still in shock, but feeling like maybe I don't need to talk to anyone about this. And then it got to a few months pass, and it got to be like, well, these are for people in acute crises, and I'm not really in that acute crisis anymore, so I guess I'm just okay. And so I've been going about my life, and over the past 2.5 years, my anxiety and my depression has gotten really bad. I don't like to, especially surrounding being alone with men, being physically touched by people, and it's gotten to the point where I'm going to seek counseling finally 2.5 years later on Friday, and one of the things we're going to be talking about is now PTSD. And I kind of feel like if I was given more care, like acutely at the beginning, I wouldn't be having to deal with maybe PTSD on the level I am now.
So let me ask you, Allie, I'm sorry for your experience. Again, this idea of going to multiple places, how many times you pick up your cell phone or your phone and ask, and did you ever go to a family doctor?
I did go to my family doctor, and that was the best resource that I actually had, was my family doctor. I had a few meetings with her. Like, she let me book a few one-hour meetings with her, and I was able to talk to her about that. And I was put on a waiting list, and I'm still on a waiting list for a program that I think is going to be very helpful. But it's like, at this point, I'm probably 6 months away from that.
But it's reassuring in a way. I want to hear from Dr. Zahn. If in your case, I know it's not a pretty picture, but Ali, your voice even brightened when you said that was the one thing that worked. So these frontline providers, the family physician, if you're lucky to have one, because that's another barrier. What are you hearing in Ali's story?
Oh, once again, everybody's stories are so complex, and again, Ellie, I'm so sorry you have had to go through this, but I'm really, really pleased to hear about the experience with your primary care physician, and certainly that's one of the thrusts of our work at CAMH, to educate and support and provide the appropriate tools for primary care physicians to be the first line of defense, that and community services. But remember, we're in a system that is severely under resourced. We know that about 15% of the burden of illness in our society is mental illness, but our healthcare budget, in our healthcare budget, funding for mental health resources is only about half of that.
Okay. So I have to hold you there because we're out of time. I want to thank you, Dr. Catherine Zahn, the president and CEO at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, and former NHL goalie Corey Hirsch. You're on Sportsnet these days, yes?
Yeah, we're I'm working with Sportsnet. I do the Connect broadcast. So
very nice. Do you ever play hockey still? What happens to guys in their mid-40s? No?
No, never.
All right, take care. Thank you, both of you, for coming in and also starting this conversation. As I've mentioned a few times, we've been tweeting a lot. There's crisis lines. You can see more of the Mental Health is Health campaign. Also, the piece is written by Corey Hirsch, one in the Players Tribune. Again, multiple darks. It's the one he's suggested to Marie and Barry. Check it out. It really is a heck of a read, a heck of a story. And, of course, take care of yourselves, everyone. Bye-bye for now.